You're tuned into the weekly media show across community radio. Nick Caldwell with you here on the Fourth Estate. Today on the show, the issue of regulating mainstream media within the highly evolved digital realm has been highly contentious in Australia. This has seen a decline in meeting local content quota guidelines on television, which has prompted Federal Communications Minister Stephen Conroy to establish a digital convergence review, as we look today at the health of locally produced content. Plus, I caught up with a man who decided to choose a writing career over a potential midlife crisis with remarkable success. So do stay tuned with me here over the next half hour. Green Senator Bob Brown is calling for a parliamentary inquiry into the Australian media, but there is a lack of agreement on how to support print media diversity. Forcing News Limited to sell some of its newspapers is promoted by some, but considered to be impossible by others. How new print media can emerge in such a heavily dominated market is a question that seems difficult to answer. Nathan Coates spoke with Senator Bob Brown about what the parliamentary inquiry should focus on.
It should look at the concentration of newspaper ownership, which is 70% in Australia, higher than any similar country in the world. That's 70% owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Limited. But we also need to be looking at the flow-on impact of ownership in the new media, in the electronic media, and the way in which the commitments of media itself, that is, for example, the journalist ethic, plays out in Australia.
Given that News Limited owns 70% of the Australian press, should they be forced to sell some of their newspapers to promote fairness and balance in the print media?
Look, I think it's very hard to see how you could do that. In a way, the horses may have bolted. There is speculation that once Rupert Murdoch retires, there may be some divestment of newspapers anyway. You know, if this were the United States with its restriction on monopolies, you wouldn't have this situation.
So given that divestment is unlikely the current situation, should we be looking at ways to promote the other 30%?
Well, I can't see how you can how government or the public interest can be served by that coming from government. It has to come from the private sector.
Eric Beecher wrote an article in Crikey a few days ago, essentially arguing that the government should use its resources to help fund new media ventures, including tax breaks for investors in independent media and diverting funding potentially from the ABC if required. What's wrong with that?
It's one of those things that an inquiry should look at if it's asked to. It's exactly the sort of thing that we should, in an open and pluralistic inquiry, be looking at.
With respect, Senator Brown, a moment ago you pointed to the private sector as being a solution. I guess what I'm putting to you, would you support the notion of government funding independent media, new media ventures, in order to overcome the barriers to entry that are there in the face of News Limited's 70% ownership?
Well, the point I'm making here is that's exactly why we need an inquiry, because there's better brains than me in and much more experienced in the wider community who can bring evidence before an inquiry so that it's an option that can be properly analysed. You're asking me to make decisions before an inquiry is even set up. Well, the very important reason why I think we need an inquiry is that so people have got new ideas about how to serve the public interest best for the future. Can come forward and an inquiry can look at that and make recommendations to Parliament and to the government.
That was the Greens leader, Bob Brown, speaking there to Nathan Coates about a government-led media inquiry. Dr. Joseph Fernandez is a media and journalism professor at Curtin University, and he also spoke to Nathan Coates about the Australian news media and whether it is in fact more opinionated and sensational, and how these pressures can affect journalists.
Does Bob Brown have a point in his recent attacks on the media, or is he just a politician frustrated with unfavourable news reports?
I think it's a mix of both, and one can debate as to how much of one and how much of the other. He seems to have spoken out in a moment of frustration, and I say that because he used French, as they say, in his recent criticisms of coverage by what he called the hate media. These are all pretty strong terms when you criticize the media. On the other hand, there appears to have been a fairly long-standing, simmering conflict that has been building up between the Australian in particular and the Greens. And I think one of the instances that points to this is the Australians' call for the Greens to be destroyed at the ballot box. One can argue whether that is something that led to Bob Brown's recent outburst. And on the other hand, you can ask whether the Australian or any other newspaper for that matter is entitled to take a position as strong as the one that was expressed in.
So on that, the Australian did respond to Senator Brown's commentary. Journalist James Masola reported, part of his report included a quote from his editor-in-chief, Chris Mitchell, saying, "We have long supported a market-based mechanism for dealing with climate change." So in saying that, the Australian has taken a political position, or is saying that they've taken a political position on climate change. Is there a problem with news producers taking a position on political issues?
You would like to think that some people would prefer that the media stayed out of it and merely gave them the facts and allowed the consumer to form their own opinions. But there is also plenty of room for advocacy journalism, and by that I mean for newspapers like the Australian to take a stand when issues are very, very significant, when there's a great deal of public concern or public interest in the matter, and climate change, carbon tax is one of those issues that the Australian has decided to take a very strong position on, and there's nothing wrong with that per se. But as long as the competing views, conflicting opinions are not left out or prevented from being aired through their media, then I would say it's okay.
And there's also been Lindsay Tenner's accusation that the media is too focused on personalities and is responsible for dumbing down content. Does a focus on opinion and personalities lead to a dumbing down of content in news reporting?
Not necessarily, but I think we have had a long-standing problem with the media, and a study was done on this more than a decade ago. There is an inadequate emphasis in media coverage on the setting out of the facts. People tend to be very comfortable with expressing opinions without providing an adequate factual foundation for those opinions, and I think that's where the problem really arises. There's no harm in expressing an opinion and even expressing opinions very strongly, but when those strong opinions are expressed without providing the consumer or the audience with the facts upon which you reach those opinions, you're not doing a service to the news-consuming public.
And I'm just wondering, in terms of the emergence of opinion generators, blogs, Twitter, and so on, do you think these media outlets, if you like, are influencing journalists to be more interesting and opinionated in their news reporting?
Yes, I think so. You know, the old filtering processes have been severely undermined by the phenomenal growth in self-publishing through the internet, through the social media, and I think mainstream media is struggling to find a new sense of balance to stay relevant in an environment where people You know, your every average Joe Blow on the street is now not deprived of the opportunity to give his or her views a venting.
And I'm also wondering if the recently the Fairfax decision to outsource sub-editing created somewhat of a culture of fear, possibly inside the media, causing journalists maybe to toe the line more in terms of editorial policies they might think are biased.
Sure, sure. Employers seem to have greater options at their disposal now to find alternatives for journalistic production. And naturally, if you do not have job security, few are the journalists who would be prepared to continue their fearless form of journalism. If you are depending on your career, on your job, it's your bread and butter, and employers have convenient alternatives at their disposal, cheaper alternatives, this potentially has a very serious chilling effect on fearless journalism.
Associate Professor in Media and Journalism, Dr. Joseph Fernandez from Curtin University there on the Fourth Estate. Australian television has changed dramatically over the past few years, as we now consider moving towards an online convergence. With the increasing amount of digital channels and more television offered online, there are concerns for the survival of Australian-made content. While the main commercial channels are required to meet quotas that require screening a certain percentage of local content, their digital counterparts are not, and the networks are happily buying up on cheap overseas programs rather than paying upwards of $1.4 million for an episode of Australian drama. Screen Australia have just released a report on the issue, and the government has commissioned an independent review into Australian content regulation and are to publish a final report in March of next year. Dylan Barber reports.
That's when good neighbours become good friends.
Neighbours might have made good friends back in the 80s, but these days it seems Aussie TV is just too expensive for our own broadcasters. At least that's what the latest findings are from Screen Australia. Their report, Convergence 2011, Australian Content State of Play, says the latest influx of digital multi-channels like 7, Mate, Go and 1HD are diluting the bite of homegrown talent in our media diet. Exempt from the stringent quotas of Australian content enforced on their main counterparts, these subsidiary stations are buying up big on cheap content from the US and the UK. Fiona Cameron, CEO of Screen Australia, says the report gives an important insight into today's media consumption.
What it has told us is that there's been a remarkable take-up of the multi-channels, which has led to an increase in television watching, up 14% across all the networks, and a remarkably resilient television sector.
In just 3 years, Australian content across all free-to-air networks has actually plunged from about 52% to 38%. And it seems, as you said, the introduction of digital multi-channels by all the major free-to-air broadcasters has been the big game-changer.
It certainly has. So the free-to-air networks have got two or three channels to fill up, if you like, and they've been filling it up with foreign content, and foreign content has been increased by 154%, and Australian content over only 59%. Now, largely that's because there are no Australian content requirements on the multi-channels, and, you know, they've got a lot of spectrum to use up, and they do deals with the US studios, and they can get content really cheaply. For example, a Two and a Half Men episode will probably cost, you know, less than $100,000, while an Underbelly would cost the network $700,000 to $900,000. And this is new release drama, so it rates pretty well. Both of those rate very well. And of course, you would be buying cheap content that rates well as your audiences are fragmenting across the channels.
However, David Knox, editor of online television blog TV Tonight, says that just because there is more foreign content on our TVs, it doesn't actually mean that homegrown content is on the decline.
The relief that Screen Australia have put out this speak has spoken about the fact that because we've now got all these wonderful digital channels, they're, of course, topped up by so much American content. And I don't think that's a revelation to anybody. If you turn on Go or 7-2 or 11 or any of those channels, you're pretty likely going to be seeing American or UK content. But that actually doesn't mean that the Australian content has dropped. Because we've now got more television, or the amount of content that we're seeing on air, therefore, does diminish. But, and then this is where I think it is a little bit misleading, it doesn't mean that suddenly we've stopped making Australian dramas. It simply means that there is more content coming in. It's misleading to say that, or to suggest that Australian production has dropped.
But with the ongoing debate, it begs the question, why is it so important that Australian content stays on our screens?
Really good question, because, I mean, the first thing you ask is, well, so what? Let the market prevail. If people want to watch the multi-channels and they're watching foreign content, that must be, you know, what they want to see. Our point is it's a little bit more complicated than that, because effectively, governments for the last 50 or 60 years have put in place government requirements and incentives for Australian drama to be on air. They've kind of had to do that because the economics of screen production are such that the US product floods our market in many other industries. This would be called dumping and illegal, but the very might of the US audiovisual sector, which has a $12 billion trade surplus, says that they can recoup the cost of a production in their own domestic economies.
Screen Australia recently hosted a number of seminars in major capital cities, as well as online, to both educate the public and generate discussion of the future of Australian television.
What we have learnt is that there is great commitment to the Australian way of life. There is a real understanding that we have a unique sense in the world. We're not monocultural, I hasten to add, but we do have, you know, something that's very hard to contrast with other countries. So I think people take it for granted a little too much. And when there is such a large amount of foreign content coming down the pipe, it's probably time to take stock and think, well, what do we need? What's the right level of Australian content? And what is it that we need to do to ensure that the industry survives and Australian stories survive?
In the end, Cameron says that Australian audiences will always have a stronger connection with local content.
Australian content gives audiences more choice, more diversity, and more competition. And bottom line is, Australian audiences want to watch it. It rates really well. So if there isn't a government requirement or a government incentive for it, it won't exist, which means there won't be choice. And other than just choice, of course, it's about our national identity and our psyche as a nation. And whenever you travel and come back to Australia, you do appreciate how very different we are and how very unique we are, our sense of humour, our sense of irony, indeed our anti-establishment view of the world. And it's that reflection on our national identity that makes Australian content on Australian screens so important.
Now, the term convergence, as we're talking about, refers to an intertwined and interrelated construction of media and communications. With TV and films increasingly moving online, what role does the internet play in all of this?
A growing role is the answer. When we look at the participation rates, which our study does look at quite extensively, you can see that, as I said, 96% of Australians are watching on their online diet is made up of traditional television. Some 20% are doing it online. That's doubled in the last 3 years. I think it will hyper-accelerate again in the next 5 years. So the difficulty for the government is they've got to keep an eye on the existing influential mediums and the ones that are about to become influential and more influential. And so in regulating in that space, I think you have to keep an eye on influence and capacity to pay. And when those influence trends change, so I think do the government requirements and incentives.
And I guess ultimately, what is the future for local production? I mean, is the convergence review something of a token gesture to the Australian production industry, or do you think we'll actually see change?
I think that the government set up this review and put a lot of money and time into this review to do something different. So I don't think the committee is of a mind to just provide the same solution. So yeah, I'm pretty confident in thinking that there'll be some real change.
Fiona Chapman of Screen Australia ending that report from Dylan Barber for the Fourth Estate. If John Gulland didn't exist, it would have been necessary to invent him. This was a remark quoted by novelist Benjamin Kunkel on the jacket flap of The Man in Question's newly released memoirs, The Man in the Grey Flannel Skirt. Although once granted by an Ivy League college education, earning himself law qualifications, John Gullion is now considered by many as the big thing in a galaxy of book writing stars. And The New Yorker began his writing career just shy of his 40th birthday. Listed as 2011's hottest breakout stars in Rolling Stone magazine, the book, published by Random House, has been well received for its quirky yet soul-bearing style, described as a unique brand of masculinity mixed with charming vanity. Just in the country to headline the Melbourne Writers' Festival as one of the eye-catching favourites, I caught up with the man in question to get him to give himself a pinch over the great success that his career has already marked.
About 3 years ago, I was 39 years old and had done very little with my life. I had a law degree that I was letting go to waste. I was living hand to mouth. I was crashing in one short-term sublet after another, and my friends, my parents had given up on me. They had pretty much resigned themselves to my never making use of my education and intelligence. So I'm 6 months shy of turning 40, which in most cultures is a real milestone. Yep. It's an existentially jarring milestone. So I,
or it's the new 21, and you can get yourself, you know.
Well, yeah, or but. Certainly wasn't for me at the time.
No.
So I was also running out of money, and so out of a need to make some money and out of a need to do something creatively meaningful and to put myself out there, I whipped out a book proposal. In the States, most nonfiction books are sold as proposals. It's an outline of the book you intend to write, and that's what the publishers buy, and then they give you a little bit of money to go off and to write the book. So I whipped out a book proposal and found an agent, and they went out with it, and that's how the book sold, and that's how I got the...
And indeed, you've received some pretty impressive acclaim. But yet, it seems like that is, you know, that's every writer's dream, right? You know, and even from those days of hand to mouth and the struggling kind of artist living it up in bohemian land. But I guess everyone aspires to that big break. Have you noticed that there's been a kind of a shift in the market or the industry since you've been paying attention even to it? In terms of book publishing?
The only shift, I suppose, is after the financial crash, publishers certainly had to deliberate a little bit more before you know.
Mm. And what about, like, is there an iPhone app version of your book?
An iPhone app version.
Yeah, can I have it on a Kindle or whatever, you know?
Sure. It's available as an ebook.
Right,
that's what they call it.
Okay, that's what they call it. And do you believe in it? And what do you make of the ebook phenomenon? Do you think that there is a ritual or a culture to reading that people will not get from the experience in reading it off an application like that?
No, words are words. And whether it's in a hardcover, paperback, or on a screen, that's the same words, right? And whatever gets people reading is certainly fine with me, right? I mean,
Sure. And now, I guess, memoirs. And something that, you know, is kind of spruced within that is the idea that this is honest and this is, you know, this is a real picture of who you are. What then is the idea of privacy to you? When that becomes, you know, when that kind of living out of your existence or that regurgitation becomes your livelihood as well.
Certainly my privacy has been compromised by the publication of this book, though there's a lot more to my life than what's in the book. A memoir is a selective presentation of somebody's life. It is the... creating a piece of art from a life, and as an autobiography, as I define it, is far more comprehensive. So there's, although I lay myself bare certainly in this book, there's still I still have my privacy.
There's still bits of you that continue to evolve beyond the pages, I guess.
Right.
I think of Clive James, who wrote, you know, a series of unreliable memoirs, and he said that basically he was just tuning into what we all do, which is, you know, inherently write about ourselves anyway, that all writing is essentially autobiographical. What do you make of that kind of idea?
Sure. I mean, writing has to come from somewhere, right? Sure, I agree with that.
You know, there's this whole thing about Google owning the rights to everyone's publication. Would you be willing to settle on a figure to have Google take away essentially the rights to your book, or is there an intellectual property thing that goes beyond money in that sense? It's your memoirs. I don't know. Would you be okay with that?
You know, I have to confess that I really don't know what's going on with the... Oh,
I thought you were legally trained. I was making, you know...
I am legally trained, but in the last 3 years of my life, I had... All I could... I just had the mental energy to try to write my book. But,
yeah.
But
it could have been quite draining, I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I didn't let myself get distracted by a lot of the legal issues bearing on.
You know, you've become part of the IT cred. You're a bit of the literati, if you will. Are you also a part of the Twitterati?
Not
you
at
kind
all.
Of take it on? Are you,
no,
you know,
I don't tweet.
No,
I don't blog.
You're in person. Yeah.
Yeah, I lay pretty low online.
And who are some of the kind of more who's someone would be surprised that you're into or influenced by?
Mailer, Norman Mailer, Philip Roth. Fellow, yeah. Marilyn Manson.
The Bronte sisters. You've been to the Melbourne Writers Festival. I mean, what was the experience like for you to kind of mingle with all these other like-minded type?
A lot of fun, yeah. I mean, it was.
What next? Are you going to have if someone offered to do a biopic of it with Vin Diesel starring as you? Would you be up for that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Good call.
I was speaking there to John Goulian, whose memoirs, The Man in the Grey Flannel Skirt, is out now via Random House. And that's it for another week here on the show. Just wanted to take the chance to thank the Humanities and Social Science Department at the University of Technology Sydney, as well as the Faculty of Arts Department at Macquarie University for financially supporting the Fourth Estate. Don't forget, you can always subscribe to the podcast at 4thestate.podomatic.com, as well as checking out all the latest happenings on the show and meeting the team just by logging onto our show website, which is 4thestateradio.blogspot.com. So, till next time, my name's Meg Caldwell. Hope you enjoyed the show, and do take care.